Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 4th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is the presenter, Chuck Schaefer. Today's session number is 98-1, and it is titled, The Ethiopian Orthodox Church, Christianity in African Form. Let's listen in.
As of July, I was appointed acting chair, so I don't know if I should request your congratulations or condolences, but in any case. But before arriving at Valpo, I have used almost every opportunity I can to try to get back to Ethiopia. Now, originally, it wasn't too hard for me to get to Ethiopia since my parents took me in utero to that place and I was born there. My folks were ALC missionaries in Ethiopia. And I lived there for approximately nine and a half years with them, and then I've used all sorts of other opportunities, including freelance writing, development work, various grants, United Nations electioneering, monitoring to as ruses to get back to Ethiopia. So it's a place that's very, very dear to my heart. What I'm going to be doing this week in the four remaining classes is talk about Christianity in Africa. And today I'm going to be talking about the Ethiopian Orthodox Church as sort of an indigenous African church that has been present in Ethiopia since the 4th century. Later on, or tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about a new kind of analysis about the impact of missions from an African perspective. And hitherto, you either condemned missionaries as being agents of imperialism or you were an apologist. Now, finally, I think we've gotten beyond that sort of dichotomy, and various people are starting to say, okay, what is the influence of this missionary impact on African political thought in the 19th and 20th century? So that's going to be my first shot at really trying to communicate what I have been reading about this past year. On Thursday, I'm going to be talking a little bit about African literature, using the book Matagiri by Ngugi Wa Thiong, who is a Kenyan writer, very prolific. He's written numerous books, but his book Matagiri is very influential. It is, well, it just has so many sort of analogies and interpretations fused throughout it, that, and much of it will build upon what I talked about on Wednesday, this new interpretation of the influence of the Bible and the missionary enterprise on political thought in Africa. And then Friday, what I'm going to be doing is looking at missions from here and into the future. The ELCA, between 1988 and 1997, grew by -2%. In Ethiopia, the Makani Yesus Church grew by 193%. In Central African Republic, the church there, the Lutheran church there, grew by 150%. In Tanzania, by 92%. That makes me question, you know, what's going on? And what I want to do is look at this new analysis about the sharing of resources in terms of missions. If we are really a church, maybe money should be sort of counted as maybe tertiary at best, and maybe the spirit foremost. And if that's the case, then we should maybe reassess how we do missions. And so I'm going to ask you to participate in that discussion on Friday. But today, what we're going to be doing is looking at some slides that I have of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. I am a historian, therefore have sort of diarrhea of the mouth. So if you have questions, please, you know, the lights will be off. I won't be able to see your hand. Just interject. And we have a resident expert here, Lee Kluth, who is pastor of Trinity Evangelical Lutheran Church in Minnesota.
And Everett, Washington.
Everett.
It looks like it's Minnesota, but it's
Everett, Washington. And he was in Ethiopia in 1996 as a partnership synod arrangement, wasn't it? With an area that I'm quite familiar with in northern Ethiopia, in Welu. So he then took a tour and has seen some of these sites, so feel free to interject and add your comments. Could you get that, and I'll get the lights. Well, what we think of when we think of Ethiopia is oftentimes that barrage of media that hit us in the winter of 84-85, when we had that calamitous famine that affected 8 million people, and mortality was around 1 to 1.5 million. And that's still sort of the lingering image of Ethiopia that I think the American public retains. But the countryside of Ethiopia is beautiful beyond words. It is as green, as verdant, as picturesque as I think the Lake District in England or any of those other sort of, you know, pieces of the world, these plots out in this global village that traditionally we have deemed as exceedingly beautiful. But you can also see that it's very rugged. Now notice the terrain. These are the highlands of Ethiopia. Most of the people live on the top of the mountains, on these tabletop mountains, and then the rivers and the ravines go down, plunge down, sometimes thousands of feet into the river valleys below, and the rivers are no longer sort of the highways that link, but actually the barriers that separate people. So it is a magnificent countryside, but a hard countryside to develop, certainly. The elevation in the highlands of Ethiopia is typically around 7,000 to 9,000 feet elevation, and then the mountains rise up from there. So 8,000 to 9,000 feet elevation is the tops of these, of Copper Mountain and Dumbbell Mountain and some of these mountains here. That is where the plains are. That is where 50 million people live, up at that kind of elevation. But Ethiopia, the civilization of Ethiopia goes back into antiquity. The Sabian Empire spanned both into Ethiopia and also into the Arabian Peninsula. And the capital, or one of the capitals, was in the city of Aksum. And there, the only remaining obelisk that stands is before you. And you can see just sort of give some indication just how tall it is. Here's a person sitting down, and a person would probably be as tall as this door here. And so you can see what a feature it is that they were able to carve that out of one block of granite and then erect it. Incidentally, the Italians cut one of these obelisks into three parts, transported it to Rome, and only this last year agreed to return it to Ethiopia. So there's going to be two of them standing pretty soon. But in any case, Ethiopia is a feudal country that has a form of feudalism as intricate and as complicated as what was present in Europe. And at the apogee of that feudal hierarchy is the monarchy itself. And there you can see some of the crowns from recent emperors. This one here is Haile Selassie, the emperor that when it rained until the very end. This is also his crown, so he had two of them. This one was Johannes, no, this one was Menelik's. This is Johannes's, and this is Tedros's crown. So you can see that the tradition of the monarchy goes back at least, well, with gaps, probably to 300 years before Christ. Here is a picture of the last monarch, Emperor Haile Selassie, that my father had the privilege of meeting on a number of occasions. But he was overthrown in 1974. So in we'll talk about it later on, but I'll press on. A feature of feudalism in Europe was that you had two-thirds of the land sort of at least in title owned by the feudal hierarchy and one-third of the land owned by the church. In Ethiopia, it was the same. And the church, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, was a very rich church in terms of its land, in terms of its power over the monarchy and over the people. And a few words about how Christianity came into Ethiopia. Back in the 4th century, two missionaries from the Orthodox See in Antioch, that is part of Turkey, set out on an expedition to, we believe, or at least tradition says, to reestablish links with the ancient churches in southern India. These were churches that supposedly the Apostle Thomas voyaged over there and established, and they were going to reconnect ties with that church. Their boat was shipwrecked on some reefs outside of Ethiopia, and these two young brothers were taken captive into the interior of Ethiopia. They were so morally correct, so wise, so literate, that they became advisors to the Emperor Cisneus, and he converted, and at least the tradition says, when after he converted, everybody converted. Well, what we really sort of believe is that maybe a few people at the top court converted, and that slowly, people converted over to Christianity in the ensuing years. I should add one more thing, that with the diaspora of the Jews, many of them fled down into the Sabian Empire. You find large communities of Jews in Yemen, and which is called Arabia Felix, Fertile Arabia, and many of them crossed over into Ethiopia itself. And so Christianity came and in certain parts supplanted Judaism, sort of a pre-rabbinic form of Judaism, but nevertheless Judaism itself. And here you can see just how important the church is in some of the festivities. What I'm going to do is take you on two little trips. One that exemplifies the antiquity of the church there, another trip that exemplifies, I think, the resurgence of Orthodoxy in its Ethiopian context. So on the first trip, we take the plane to the international airport at Lalibela. And of course, you get off this plane, and then you have to go through customs and all that at the terminal. And there's the terminal.
There's a corrugated metal building there now.
Oh boy, advancement. It's amazing what progress does. But you can drive here from the main road, which is of course mud and gravel and all that. It's 70 kilometers over these kinds of rugged mountains here to get into Lalibela. We drove it twice in our four-wheel drive Mitsubishi Pajero. And to go that 70 kilometers, it took us an around 4 hours. So we were going, averaging maybe about 10 miles an hour. This is through rivers, over mountains. Sometimes you'd have to rebuild the road that washed out in the last rain and all that kind of stuff. Well, I better not go on with these kind of stories. But in any case, we get to this magnificent city of La Libella, and you can see just how advanced it is and how well the people live. Ethiopia, well, we Africanists, when we're thinking of Ethiopia or Africa, we always look at Southern Africa as, oh, that's Africa for beginners, you know. And then there's West Africa, yeah, that's Africa. But then there's really Africa. And that's the interior of Ethiopia, parts of the southern part of Sudan where it's all swamps, where tsetse flies rain and all that, and where it's really impoverished. And so here, you know, this is a very, very impoverished part of Africa.
You're getting up at 8,000 or 9,000 feet here? Or?
I believe, I would imagine, yeah. I did have an altimeter. You got that. I somewhere between 7 and 8, 8.5, and then the mountains go up, and so there, we'll talk a little bit about that, because there's a lot of rock-hewn churches up in the mountains, and so you can rent mules or walk here in La Libella and go for days and days into the highlands and see one rock-hewn church after another. But in any case, what is the feature, what is the sort of the... what brings tourists to La Libella? It is the fact that there are 11 rock-hewn churches. Back in the late 11th century, early 12th century, King Lalibela had, or actually his wife had a dream that she should consecrate some churches and build them out of the kinds of rocks that were there. And she communicated this to her husband. He, of course, being a good being a typical husband, I should say, not good, slash that word, being a typical husband, sort of denied that his wife could ever really tell him anything until he, you can see I'm sort of searching for words here, trying to be politically correct, but having a difficulty doing so. He had similar visions shortly thereafter, and then in his lifetime, he galvanized his empire of the central part of Ethiopia and had them carve these rock-hewn churches. And it is truly amazing. This is not blocks. This is solid rock. And we will see more evidence of them. On the outskirts, you can see parts of the palace. This is actually part of his stables that he had carved out, and I don't know how the horses got in there, but that's how what tradition says. And here we start walking on some of the footpaths over to see various other churches. And you can see that, indeed, life is very harsh. Here women are carrying water. These big earthen jugs are full of water. Now I've lifted a few of them, and I would imagine that they are around 70 pounds. These women are probably maybe 4 foot eight, 4 foot, I don't know, 10, somewhere in there. Maybe 110 pounds maximum, and they will walk down each day about maybe anywhere from maybe a mile to 5 miles, fill up the earthen jugs, and walk back. And then in the this is later on in the day. In the early morning, they've already gone out to carry big bundles of firewood back to their houses. So life is very, very harsh. But in any case, this is the only church that actually the queen, King Lalibela's wife, commissioned. And you can see that it is indeed crumbling a little bit because of air pollution. I wish my wife yesterday had talked about pollutants floating across large expanses of the world, because indeed, Ethiopia, where there's, I don't think there's a car in Lalibela, is suffering from air pollutants that are affecting the kind of sandstone that they use here. And around them, there is a constant number of pilgrims that walk incredible distances to go to each of these churches and say a litany of prayers. And here you can see some of the men going doing that. Notice this long stick that he is holding here. This is a walking stick, but it's called a prayer stick. And at the very top of it is sort of like a little crutch. And you have that for two purposes. The services typically last about 3 to 5 hours long. There's a chair here, so this sort of negates what I'm saying, but typically there's not chairs, and they have to stand. And so what they do is they either prop them under an arm and lean on them, or just prop them under their chin and sort of lean forward on them to take a little bit of the pressure off of their legs and knees and ankles and so forth. Here is another church, perhaps the biggest, and we'll see. You can just see how large it is in comparison to the human perspective.
In fact, to stand there at the foot of those churches and to see the intricacies of the windows and of the designs, and to know that people, did that by hand, from the ground down, and then they had to somehow get the dirt out, and I don't know where the dirt went, but just awestruck to know that many, many, many hands carved those from the red rock.
Yeah.
This is all solid rock.
One piece. Yeah.
Now my question is, how did they find a suitable piece of rock without any fissures in it? How many times did they maybe excavate and then find out 10 feet down in building the boat that actually there's a big crack and that they have to start over again? And I don't know those questions, but these are really a testament to human energy, really. And it happened. Most of these were completed in a time span of around 65 years.
Now, Chuck, would these have been built by, say, slaves of the king, like the pyramids were? Are these people who are doing it as an act of faithful service, or how does that work?
In Ethiopian culture, you're not supposed to have, Highland Christian culture, you're not supposed to have slaves, although they had slaves. But this was mostly an act of piety, and both towards the polity, that is the political forces around to King Lalibela, and also as an act of homage to God.
How old are these buildings again?
About 900 years old now. Perhaps there's 11 of them, and I'm not going to show you all of them. But this is perhaps the most famous. And you can just see how you have to walk across these fissures and how the countryside, if this thing hadn't been carved out, how the hillside would just sort of maybe have a little bit of a knoll here and then go down here. And you could well imagine some sort of Ethiopian engineer 900 years ago looking at that knoll and saying, maybe we'll make another church right in here. But in any case, what they do is they go over here and then they just build a moat. And the next slide will illustrate a little bit more. They'll cut down quite a bit, quite far in fact, and they'll cut this moat. Then they begin to cut the outsides. Then they cut into the solid rock and hew out a whole church with pillars, with ornamentation all up to the very ceiling, and then some of them they embellish them with paint, in others not so. But you can see that, just how far down it is. That's about three stories.
That's the same one?
That's the same one as this one and this one, just from different perspectives.
And to get down there, you have to go into a rather narrow moat. And that's my daughter at about age 3. And we're coming down there. You're supposed to take off your shoes to show reverence. What they do to, I think, take the dampness away or maybe add dampness or whatever is they put hay on the floor. And Ethiopia is a great place for fleas. And so you go in and Lee, did you experience that too?
Not really, no.
Oh, really? What season?
We were in November.
That makes a difference. That's not flea season.
That's the problem.
But in any case, what we tried to do is wear white socks. And then after visiting the interior of each church, we would typically sit on these steps and just pick off the fleas from our white socks and try to get them before they
got healed.
Yeah. But the interiors of these are truly spectacular. And notice, here's an interesting feature. You have the cross with the Star of David right around it. And this, again, points to sort of the melange of the Judaic tradition with this old form of Christianity of antiquity. The Ethiopian church derives its theology from the Antioch church. So it's monophysite. What does that mean? Oh, boy. Essentially, there were a number of conferences back in the 3rd and 4th centuries. One of the first one was the Council of Nicaea, where we come up with the Nicene Creed. But then there were other splits that seemed to be splitting the Roman Catholic Church away from the Orthodox churches. And these were over the nature of Christ. And I, maybe 18 years ago, I read a tome, about 600 pages, and about the Monophysite Church. And I think I can encapsulate the gist of those 600 pages in this. I think the Western tradition says when Christ came to earth, he was in and of God. Now he's both. He's divine, yet he's human, and that's part of the paradoxes that we deal with. The Orthodox Church was far less comfortable with that, especially if the crucifixion was supposed to sort of reify what we as human beings feel. And they thought that when Christ came down on earth, he was human. And so it's a matter of prepositions that split the Catholic Church away from the Orthodox churches. And then the Orthodox churches typically had other disagreements that separated them. So the Ethiopian Orthodox Church theologically is closer to the Armenian Orthodox to the church in Antioch, which isn't quite the Greek Orthodox. But politically, it's often called the Coptic Church because the patriarch in Alexandria in Egypt was the person who appointed the archbishop in Ethiopia. So politically, it was always tied to Egypt and Alexandria. But it took on very unique forms, and it sort of indigenized itself in the Ethiopian culture. I'm not exactly sure what this means, but remember, Ethiopia is, even to this day, primarily illiterate, and therefore images are a worthy vehicle for communication of the biblical stories. Now, each major religious site has its own cross, and this is the cross of Lalibela. And you'll notice you have the cross here, various wings of angels on here. These 12 heads are supposed to represent the 12 disciples, and I think this is supposed to represent some other biblical figure. maybe Abraham, I'm not exactly sure. I can't quite remember. But it's stylized, and whenever you see one, you know that that's a Lalibela cross. Conversely, this is a cross of Aksum. That's another pilgrimage site, and it is distinct in its form, too. Now, the churches in Aksum send representatives and sometimes sort of deacons or monks to the other pilgrimage sites, so he's probably on a pilgrimage from Aksum to Lalibela. People in Ethiopia are very devout, and here this guy is reading probably various books, I'm not sure which, in an ecclesiastical language called Ge'ez, which is sort of like Latin. They don't really speak it, they chant it, but it's not used in conversation, and this book and many others are actually written on parchment.
What's the alphabet of that language?
It's a syllabary. And so I can read it, but I don't know what I'm reading because the syllabary is the same as we have in Amharic. It has 290 letters. But I would be able to, it would just be mumbo jumbo to me. But there's also many young Ethiopians who commit themselves to Christianity at a very young age and enter and become deacons. And they have to go through a long sort of process. And so as we were stumbling around these ruins, we came on this nice little vantage point in this one bell tower, and there was this little kid, maybe 12, 13 year old, curled up on this ledge here, reading his Bible, committing it to memory. And he was going through the Orthodox form of ecclesiastical education, and memorizing large, large chunks of the Bible.
Chuck?
Yes?
In Latin America, when the Spaniards were there, it was one of the things that the wealthier families did was commit their children to the church. Mm-hmm. But also, it was one way that poor people could sort of advance themselves, mm-hmm. so they would give their children to the church. Does the same sort of process happen here?
Can I pick that up in a few more slides? Because I'm going to talk about land and kinship and how it fits into the church.
Okay.
But I will try to get back to that. But you also see many, many hermits in Ethiopia, and especially at these major religious sites. And this is an old woman who has just become a hermit. She, in around the walls of all of these excavation sites, are tiny little caves carved into it. And this cave, literally, is maybe, I would say, maybe a third of the size of the screen inside. And that is her home. She is able to squat in it. The ceiling is about this high. I literally could not get in there. Kathy could. And she's a lot lighter than I. Krista could. But I had to sort of put my head in and look in. And she could lie down in a sort of a fetal position, and that was about it. And she lives there. And many of the pilgrims will actually camp out in little parts of the walls that are hewn out. Now, these things that are hewn out are oftentimes tombs. And so when you're walking past these things, I don't know if I think I've maybe excerpted the photos that had the bones in them, but oftentimes you'll see bones and actually sort of human beings that are in the process of decaying, and with all the stench and everything. But after they decay enough, or after the hyenas get the bones and carry them off, then pilgrims will go in and sweep them out and use them to camp out in. During the main festivals, one last point, during the main festivals in Lalibela, people will walk from as far as 300 miles away. And we've never managed to get there during a major festival, but it's supposedly just amazing. There's up to 70,000 people all in their sort of their white garb. In the early mist of the morning, it is translucent, and the chanting goes on all night, all day. It just takes your spirit up. It really is something else. But in any case, typically in Ethiopia, churches are built in the round. And women in some churches are not supposed to enter the outer sanctum. In other churches, they can enter the outer sanctum, and then there'll be an inner circle in there where men can go. And then in the very core of the church is sort of a holy of holy area where only the priests and the abbots and monks can go. And each church is supposed to have a little bit of the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant, tradition says, is now in Ethiopia. And so no one can actually see into those places, except if you're the top priest of that church. Now, the Ethiopian countryside is divided into parishes. And that is the smallest sort of rubric of governance in Ethiopia. But Ethiopia is not as sexist as most other countries. Both men and women can inherit land. It's called ambulineal descent systems. And so say you have a household here. The mother and the father die off, they have three sons, four daughters, and say these were their fields around here. All sons and daughters have equal access to that land. Well, that was fine and good when population was relatively stable. But in the 20th century, we've had a population boom. And everybody seems to be accessing land, claiming land, and there's a lot of litigation and enormous amount of land fragmentation. Now, typically this has happened in more of the well-urbanized or well-inhabited areas. So oftentimes, third and fourth sons would then, and this is to answer your question, Julie, would then opt to go into the church at a very young age. Why? Because the church typically owned a third of the land, and so they could supplement the land that they didn't inherit from their parents through service to the church. Well, I don't know why I put that. I must have had some kind of transition slide there, and I forgot what it was. But in any case, what happened in 1974? The Emperor Haile Selassie was arrested. There was a coup. Later on, we're pretty certain he was actually poisoned. And what we got instead was 17 years of Marxism under the dictator of Mengistu Haile Mariam. And of course, here you can see Lenin, Marx, and Engels. In the Ethiopian, this is called the Sost Christot, which means the three, I think it loosely translates to the three stooges. The Ethiopians don't really think that highly of Marxism as it was supplanted in Ethiopia. But what did Marxism do? And this is one of the things I want to mention. It nationalized all land, from both the monarchy, from the old feudal hierarchy, and from the church. The monarchy and the old feudal hierarchy were destitute. The church had to reinvent itself. And Marxism came. It was a 17-year history of atrocities, abuses. From 77 through 79 is called the Red Terror in Ethiopia. And literally, thousands of youth were just killed, exterminated by the Marxist dictatorship because they had ideas that contradicted Mengistu's. And there was just one catastrophe after another, including the famines of 1984 and 85, where 1 to 1.5 million people died. Well, what was the institution that could speak out against the government? It was the church. Let me say a couple things about language in Ethiopia. Ge'ez and Amharic, Tigrinya are very complex Semitic languages that have both a wax level and a gold level of meaning. So you can say something at the wax level which will be biblical, which will not be offensive even in written form. But the gold level of interpretation and meaning can contradict the wax thing and actually be a statement against the government, a statement against the extant order that is present in Ethiopia at that particular time. And so it was the church, through Samanawuk, which means this wax and gold interpretation, that was able to speak against the government. And all of a sudden, the church, deprived of its land, deprived of its wealth, had to then cater to the people. Prior to that, it was sort of a dying church. It was very moribund. There wasn't much vitality in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Since then, since Mengistu, the church has been revitalized in ways that 20, 30 years ago, nobody could have imagined. So, what do you, I guess I put that in. What do we have now? We have Ethiopia now led by extreme Democrats. trying to read backwards. But in any case, the government that has supplanted the Mengistu regime is also, they were sort of born, back in the 60s when sort of a Marxian view of the world and politics was the order of the day, and even though they seem to be democratic, at least in rhetoric, I think the telling word is extreme. And so even since the change in government in 91 up to the present, politics and the people are not always on the same page. That's pretty lightly. And again, the church is taking this position against the current realities in Ethiopia. And here we're going on our next expedition to see how vital this church is right now. So we're heading up Mount Zukwala. Mount Zukwala, at the top of this volcano, is about almost 13,000 feet high. So once you get up to about, with this old Nissan, when I got up to around 11,000 feet, I'd have to pop the hood and retard the timing a little bit so that it would still run up to 13,000 feet. But in any case, we got up there, and this was a major festival. There's three major festivals. The Mezcal, which is the time of the Festival of the Cross, which is September 15th around. Timket, which is Epiphany, and then of course Easter. They really downplay Christmas. And so this is Epiphany, and you can see that the head priests are coming out in all of their regalia, with all their robes filigreed with real gold. Some of these are 200 and 300 years old. And then, I think we can see it. Oh, no, back. Back right in here is the Ark of the Covenant being carried under vestments. And they're processing in this procession that's here.
Question?
Yeah.
You said the church now is continuing to play a role politically.
Yeah. Speaking out against the current government.
Are they, is there a central organization among the churches that set an agenda? How does that happen?
No. The current Archbishop of Ethiopia, actually the current Patriarch, because it's separated from the
the church, Coptic Church in Egypt, is sort of a puppet of the current government. And so independent churches or, you know, well-established leaders in within the church are voicing opposition to the patriarchy and to the government because they seem to be in the same, in bed together. And they are.
So do those churches get reprimanded?
Sometimes. Now, an interesting feature of Christianity in Ethiopia is it doesn't seem to be as exclusive as one typically thinks of Orthodox churches. On the other side of this lake, in the crater, is a ceremony going on called the Zar. Zar is a kind of possession cult. And so while the religious ceremony is going on at one side of the lake, the Zar ceremony is going on at the other, and that's the leader of the Zar ceremony. And they get into trance, they smoke a lot of ganjas, dope, they do all sorts of incantations, mostly at night, and then they try to survive the next day. And, you know, sometimes I think it takes their effects on their eyes at least. And this is going on during this Christian religious ceremony. The astounding thing is that at a certain point in the goings-on of the Tsar ceremony, when the church is going to actually conduct some major ceremony, some Eucharist or something like that, the leader of the Tsar cult will tell people that they should go to the church. So he's asking his congregants, so to speak, to go and participate in the ceremony. So they all trek across the lake and participate in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Now the Ethiopian Orthodox Church doesn't really condone it, but it doesn't really condemn it either. You know, they just tolerate it, knowing full well that many of their people are very much practice both Christianity and African traditional religion. That's sort of an aside. But here the ceremony starts, and you can see just thousands. Is that in focus? I'm so close I can't see. Thousands and thousands of congregants have walked up 13,000 feet to participate in a three-day ceremony, and then on the third day, everybody walks down to the lake. And there is the shot of the lake, and you can see that this huge crowd essentially spans the lake, and they're supposed to walk around the lake seven times. On the seventh time, the water is consecrated. It is made into the water of the River Jordan, and then people will take little containers back home to use in their own religious ceremonies, or if there is a baptism in their village, then people will pay them for that water. This woman is actually walked approximately 300 miles to get to this ceremony over the kind of rugged terrain that you saw at the very beginning. No telling how old she was, but I estimate probably over 60, all by herself. Here's some other pictures of some of the participants in this rite. Some of them will just stop and have some coffee. Coffee actually comes from Ethiopia, from the province of Kaffa. That's an aside. And people come from all walks of life. Here's, you know, young and old, impoverished and fairly wealthy too. In fact, one of the top government officials, talking about inappropriate, had a helicopter, a military helicopter, drop him down so he could participate in at least one of the tours of the lake, and then he got back into his helicopter and disrupted the whole ceremony and took off and went back out of Seoul. But in any case, it goes on and on and on.
Chuck, the white garb is
something
you've had on, particularly
for
this occasion.
No. Everybody, that's homespun cloth. Okay. And they wear it. It's their sleeping bag. It's their blanket. It's their coat. It's everything.
Okay.
Yeah. They walk like 100 miles and other people feed her on that trailer. She could go to anybody's house and say she's a pilgrim and expect hospitality, expect to be sheltered, expect to be fed, expect to have anything done for her because she's a religious pilgrim.
How long would that take?
I think she walked from various pilgrimage sites. So I think she had been on the road for about maybe 6 weeks or so. And she had gone to various other religious sites. I know she went to Deber Marcos and Deber Libanos before coming here.
Is it common for women to travel along as pilgrims and not?
Yeah, it was quite common. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here he's, various people are wading down into the lake, into the reed beds. Once the water has been consecrated, and are filling containers which they will take back with them, because this is the Water Jordan now. The moss from the trees around is also consecrated in some way, and I'm not sure exactly the symbolism of that, but other kids, we sort of weave it into beards, and that is to show that they are actually deacons of the church and someday will be wise priests of or monks of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And that's to depict the wisdom that comes with age that they are embarking upon. But you will also see hermits who have traveled long, long distances. This guy, that's all he owns, really. A couple goat skins, a shama underneath, and a stick. That's probably it. And people will just feed him. This guy... Oh, I gotta get that in focus. Oh, that's not working. Can somebody fiddle with the focus up there?
Try it now, Andrew.
See if you're... Oh, sorry.
Does it do anything?
No. Can you just use that? Oh, there.
I don't think that's it
either. Well, maybe it's not. Maybe it's just his hand is in focus. Oh, okay. But it, yeah, there we go. This guy, I had a hard time walking it, but he walked up. And then we gave him a ride down. Actually, I ferried him and a few other people down and came back up and picked up the family. But I believe he was born sometime around the Battle of Adwa, or at least he claimed. So he could have been sort of in his 90s. He remembered the First World War. He remembered the Italian occupation. So he was just this repository of history. And since I'm a historian, I was just taking copious notes. You know, we'd get onto a story, and I'd be going down the hill, and then I'd say, wait a minute, slam on the brakes, pull the handbrake, grab out my little pad of paper and start writing down. Because, you know, a lot of his stories sort of contradicted what some of the books were saying. But he is a priest from Deber Libanos, and you can tell because of the church, the fashion of his cross. So he had come on this pilgrimage also.
So here, they're speaking in English?
No, he was speaking in Amharic. I know Amharic.
And then you can, she is a, at best, of a nunnery, somewhere, what is it?
I don't know.
Convent.
Thank you. And I'm not exactly sure where, but she was very much revered by everybody who passed her. They would all often kiss her hand. This woman is there just to assist her.
Now, could you tell that by the garb she's wearing?
Yeah.
So the yellow garb would be distinctive to a woman who's in a convent or to any religious?
No, I think that would be to the woman as the head of a convent.
All right.
That best. And here we come to the sort of the tail end of our excursion around the lake. And finally, we head down the mountainside, and you can see Krista's a little bit worn out from all these excursions, and we head back to Addis Ababa. let me turn on the lights, and I'll say a few words on entertaining, sort of as a postscript to this talk. What's going on in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church today? Well, I think I tried to communicate that it has been revitalized because of Marxism, but that revitalization has taken all sorts of twists and turns that the hierarchy, the patriarchy, doesn't quite expect. And the latest sort of issue that the Ethiopian Orthodox Church is dealing with is speaking in tongues, sort of the evangelical movement that seems to be in all churches. It's in the Lutheran Church in Ethiopia, it's in the Orthodox, it's now spreading into the most conservative Orthodox Church. And so you're sort of getting parallel structures, parallel sources of authority within the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. One who are filled with the Spirit and have all these gifts, and say, well, you're not quite true Christian unless you have these. And then the old guard were saying, well, no, that's not what the tradition says. And so there seems to be sort of a power struggle within the Ethiopian Orthodox Church right now. But church services are well attended. Our apartment in Addis Ababa was about a block away from one of the major churches, or actually a block away from one, two blocks away from another. And so there are so many religious days. And at about 5 a.m, this was shocking the first couple times we heard it. 5 a.m, you hear cannon go off. Boom, boom, boom. Another war, another coup. And what it was a call for people to come to the church and begin the ceremony. And the ceremonies just go all day and all night. It is that this what I failed to get was pictures of the night during the Atsu Kwala, when everybody was, you know, you just sort of push somebody to the side, you push it, you find a tiny little narrow area, you'd lay down there, you'd pull your white shama over you, and you could look both through at the courtyard around that church, and you would almost believe that you were in Holden in winter. It looked like snow, you know? And it was just thousands of people sleeping there. It's just a marvelous place. Yeah, any questions? Yeah.
The movement of the evangelical movement, the speaking in tongues, how much of that is also drawn from traditional spirit possession, where you go into trance and speak to the spirits and et cetera, and then you get the blending together of the Orthodox with the really traditional?
I'm not sure. I can't quite answer that question. Because certainly, you know, with Tsar, the Tsar possession cult, you saw that.
Right.
Oh my goodness, some of the, what I didn't have here was our video of some of those sort of possession rites. I don't think they see it that way, because Tsar in Ethiopia is more a woman's domain, with a few males who are sort of
That's astonishing parallels with the Brazil. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, which is also derived from the African influence, but it was from West Africa, not East. But it's a women's movement as well.
Yeah.
But there is this blending of the Catholic Church and the spirit possession.
Chad, I was beginning to bounce off you because I'm not going to be here in the latter part of the week and interested in what you're thinking about. And that is you're seeing a revitalization in Ethiopia coming out of the Marxist period. And I've had some time in Asia and I'm very fascinated what's happening in China, where it's coming out of a communist into kind of an intellectual spiritual void. And I'm wondering, from your vantage point, do you see some common streaks? It seems to me that in China, we have no idea where it's moving. All we know is that there's a tremendous vitality and enthusiasm and involvement and growth and home churches, and nobody really knows how big it is. And whether coming out of Marxist philosophy, this is saying something. I'm wondering what your perspective is.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I think the point I was trying to make, and maybe I didn't make it in these words, is that God works in incredibly strange ways. Taking a military lieutenant and who had an eighth grade education and had a very superficial knowledge of what Marxism was like, and really was using that to pad his own wallet, and using him as a vehicle to revitalize a pretty moribund church. Now, what's happening in China, I'm not really sure, but yeah, I hear the reports that you're talking about, and I don't know, but I think the what we can just sort of hold on to is that maybe we don't need to quantify converts. Maybe we don't need to count the number of home churches in China. Maybe we should be satisfied simply knowing that that many people in China are finding a spiritual life in Christianity in China. Sort of a roundabout easy way of explaining, but I'm not quite sure.
Just a couple things. When we were there, Dereje Jambero, who's the executive director of the North Work Area of the Evangelical Ethiopian Evangelical Church, Makana Yesus, was when he was a younger man during the Marxist time, was one of the Marxist leaders of where he lived in Desi, was kind of after him because he was a believer. Mm-hmm. And when the Marxist government was overthrown, this man was thrown in jail, and Dereje would visit him in jail. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of a reversal, and of course more details to that story, but Dereje was our guest, or our host when we were there. Yeah. And one thing in response to your question, we were there at the dedication of a church that our Northwest Washington Synod sent some money with the ELCA Division of Global Mission to build, go from a tent, like an old army tent, to build a church. And we were invited to come to the dedication, and the service was 4 hours and 15 minutes long in Amharic, as Chuck spoke of. And one of the things that the women did, I think at the service, was, and I'll do it, I won't scare anybody, but go, right, oftentimes, in the middle of the service, and just the first time that happened, I like jumped out of the pew. But just the outflowing of the spirit. And we were there for 2 weeks among the people in northern Ethiopia, our companions, and that spirit was just alive in prayer meetings, in church services, in homes, and it was just exciting to feel that spirit of growth. Mm-hmm. And like you said, that 193% growth in the Makana Yesus Church was just exciting.
What kind of government is in Ethiopia now?
It's Mele Zenawi is the leader, and it was a Tigrinian secessionist movement against the Marxist Derby that took over and expelled Marx, or this dictator. But he was educated in the bush. He was sort of weaned on Marxism. And so, but he is a brilliant man. And he has learned the rhetoric of capitalism and free markets and democracy so bloody well that you think, goodness sakes, Clinton, could you just take a lesson from this guy? He talks a heck of a lot better line than you do. But I think fundamentally, he does not want to share. He is fearful of transparency within the political system, which is essentially how Marxism has been implemented in the 20th century. And he mirrors that same sort of anxiety about encouraging the political process. And so it is oppressive. This last year I have been doing a lot of expert testimony for Ethiopians seeking political asylum in the United States. And my gosh, the testimonials that I am, you know, the affidavits that I am reading are just amazing. Very, very brutal. Mm. But secret. I mean, these guys are a lot smarter than the old guy.
I was just going to make a comment that I work for Jewish Family Services in Seattle, and we, you know, continue to settle a lot of Ethiopian Jews. And talking with them about the persecution that that they still exist, you know, and they're wanting to go to Israel, but finding in Israel they're also persecuted, so then eventually coming to the U.S.
May I just make a comment? I know our time is up, so if any of you need to go, that would be fine. But with the famine in 1984, you know, there was about 1% of the population was still Jewish. They were called Falasha, and now they're sort of known as the Beta Israel. And there was attempts, Operation Solomon and Operation Moses, between the American government and the Israeli government to identify who these people were, to ferry them out of Ethiopia, put them on military transports, and evacuate them to take them over to Israel. And so now Ethiopia hardly has any Jewish population at all. There's a few people who still claim to be Jewish, but. Now both the Israeli government and the Ethiopian government are pretty jaded about it because people are thinking, boy, I can make more money in Israel than I can in Ethiopia. I'm going to be Jewish. And so it's a hard thing to prove. I saw a question over here, I think.
I was just making a comment about that, where I was curious because the charismatic movement in Mexico, for example, I mean, there's an element there of is more spiritual at times, and yet one of the things that is a concern about the carismáticos in Mexico, for example, is that it's actually working against the liberation theology element of the Catholic Church that is more liberal and trying to be more critical of the government. And so what they're using is Pentecostalism within the Catholic Church and within other sort of more Protestant groups as a way of, in essence, sort of in the traditional sense of getting people to focus more on just their lives and not to critique and not to be in opposition. And that's very strong right now in Mexico. So it's sort of interesting that on the one hand there's a spiritual element to it, and yet there's also a very political element. So when you start thinking about, you know, the church or Marxism or any of these things, one of the things that is always a concern to me is what is the intent behind that and who are the movers behind it? Because Marxism in and of itself doesn't do anything, just as Christianity in and of itself doesn't do anything. It's people that move in and around that. And so it's sort of interesting to see in some places where it is sort of a genuine, you know, increase in spirituality, and yet in other ways it tends to actually be more conservative and prevent some of that. Social justice.
In Ethiopia, I think it's just the opposite. I think the old hierarchy is more conservative, more prone to say, well, let's just wait this out, or are working hand in hand with the government. And it is the charismatic, the evangelical element within the Orthodox Church who is speaking out and is far more radical and asking for representation, asking for better land distribution, lower taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And it says, well, I think we've gone over a little bit, but I think we stopped at least the formal presentation on time. But thank you very much, and if you have any more questions, you can.